Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Nobody likes to talk about needing it, but we all like knowing it's there. A new series begins on the broadcast today. Show me your safety net. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for a Tuesday. This one's the 26th of March. Good as always to have you with us. And here is what we are not going to do today. We're not going to talk about Cyprus. We're not going to talk about the Eurozone or the deficit or lost productivity because of March Madness. No, what we are going to do is talk about big picture economic indicators, two of them specifically, that should give some reason for hope. Item number one, housing. The Case-Shiller Home Price Index came out this morning. Loads of city-by-city data in there, as always. Here's the takeaway headline for you. Last month, U.S. home prices took their biggest jump since 2006, which, if you do the math, is before the crash. Item number two, durable goods orders, big, heavy stuff, supposed to last more than 3 years. Orders were up sharply last month, a positive measure of American manufacturing activity. Again, a reason for hope. So we got that. In corporate news, there were some goings-on in the wireless phone space today. T-Mobile is out with a new pricing plan. No more locking you into one of those two-year contracts with steep early cancellation penalties. Also, no more subsidizing the cost of your new smartphone, meaning you'll get to pay full price. Complicated. Just like a cell phone bill, huh? Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman unravels it for us.
At my favorite internet cafe, are there any non-internet cafes anymore? There are plenty of smartphones out, including builder Andy Powell's iPhone.
I got it with the two-year plan. I think it probably costs $200.
Only not really, because every month he's paying AT&T a little extra to cover the company's subsidy. It makes that iPhone seem cheap at $200 instead of its actual cost of $600 or so. This is what T-Mobile is trying to change.
Finally, we have a carrier who's really being honest about what it costs to actually get a phone in your hand.
Maggie Reardon writes the Ask Maggie column at CNET.
Now people can pay for their phone up front or they can finance it over 24 months and they don't have a contract. Once you finish paying off your phone, then the cost of your monthly bill actually goes down.
Reardon says bills at T-Mobile will be lower than at AT&T and Verizon. Analyst James Moorman at S&P says those competitors have to make up all the money they spend on subsidies, but they will be watching.
If it's successful, sure, I think everybody'd like to get rid of the subsidy model.
But will T-Mobile find customers ready to plop down the full unsubsidized cost of a smartphone? Again, Andy Powell.
Yeah, whether I want to drop $600 for a phone kind of competes with a lot of other interests at the same time.
T-Mobile may find a lot of us like getting something cheap now and paying more later. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Speaking of getting things cheap, the music streaming service Spotify lets you listen to millions of songs anytime you want for free, although you may have to sit through an ad for mac and cheese or a new car or something along the way at some point. It is pretty popular, but losing money like it's going out of style. For every dollar that Spotify takes in, it pays out 98 cents in licensing fees. So it's looking for new ways to get users to part with their money, as Marketplace's David Weinberg explains.
If Spotify were a restaurant, it would be an all-you-can-eat buffet. You can listen to as many songs as you want for free, as long as you listen to the occasional ad. Or you can pay a subscription fee of $10 a month to get the songs without the ads. Sam Hameda is the CEO of the research firm PIVCO. He says Spotify's problem is that it's underpricing its service.
So imagine a restaurant that charged $5. Obviously, they're going to be those people that eat an enormous amount.
I have to be honest here. I'm one of those people. I listen to a ton of music on Spotify, everything from 60s pop songs to Italian dinner music. And every time I play a song, Spotify has to pay a licensing fee. Even though I pay the subscription fee, chances are I'm still costing Spotify money. The good news for Spotify is that subscriptions are up.
And that's actually quite an encouraging sign for their long-term health.
Dan Cryon is Senior Director of Digital Media at IHS. He says that one thing Spotify has done well is create a platform where people can listen to music on all their devices.
So the question becomes, once you've got music to where people want to listen to it, What else can you do to add value?
One possible way is to offer video. Spotify could create its own music-related show, like American Idol or The Monkees. Crayon says that a better model for Spotify to follow would be the Metropolitan Opera. The Met has been successful at getting users to pay to watch performances online. Spotify, for example, could offer the same service for concerts. I'm David Weinberg for Marketplace.
I don't actually believe Weinberg listens to that Italian dinner music, I gotta tell you. If you met him, you'd know what I'm talking about. All right. Anyway, you know that rule when you're on a plane when they make you shut down all your electronics for takeoff and landing? Well, it is, hallelujah, up for review by a government panel. They are supposed to make a recommendation this summer sometime. Maybe. Shannon Mullen reports.
The panel just met for the first time in January and plans to recommend new standards for devices on planes by July. But Missouri Democratic Senator Claire McCaskill says that's not fast enough.
If somebody is not being a squeaky wheel on this, it could be years, knowing how long this process typically takes.
McCaskill points out that the FAA lets pilots use iPads in the cockpit instead of paper flight manuals, and she says there's no hard evidence that other devices like e-readers and laptops interfere with planes.
Unless and until somebody shows me any of that data, I feel a sense of obligation to keep pushing to make this rule change as quickly as possible.
McCaskill says she's already drafting legislation to change the policy.
Makes me wonder, you know, what are we doing there if people like herself have already decided that she wants a certain result and, you know, we better come up with it.
Doug Kidd is head of the National Association of Airline Passengers, and he's on the panel. He argues there's no evidence that today's devices don't affect planes, and new devices hit the market every day. And he says most people don't mind reasonable rules during takeoff and landing.
Since the most dangerous part of any flight, it's also the time that most accidents occur. So we'd rather not take a chance on distracting the flight crew at this period of time.
The FAA would not comment on McCaskill's push for action. Kidd says the panel's progress might seem slow, but Congress is not exactly known for its efficiency either. In Boston, I'm Shannon Mullen for Marketplace.
David Weinberg just stuck his head in the studio, said he does too listen to Italian dinner music. All right, on Wall Street today, more would-be buyers than sellers. Details, numbers, you know the drill. Congress out of town for the next couple of weeks. Political Washington is mostly quiet. It's a welcome break from the usual who did what to whom bill of fare. Once they get back, though, before the brawl gets going again, a lot of lawmakers are going to be talking about the tax code and an overhaul thereof, specifically corporate taxes. And that conversation will bring with it much input from tax lobbyists. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer has that story.
A lot of politicians have climbed on the tax reform bandwagon. One idea gaining traction, eliminate some tax loopholes for businesses. But that's not going over well in corporate suites. Many companies are gearing up to defend their cherished tax breaks, even if they seem a little loopy.
When he makes it by.
NASCAR track owners get to write down the value of their speedways in record time. And video game makers get research and development tax credits meant for new technologies, even when they're just making updated versions of existing games.
Thank you.
And Starbucks? It gets a manufacturing tax credit for roasting coffee beans. That may sound crazy, but Starbucks spokesman Zach Hudson says the company uses its tax savings to open new roasting facilities, creating jobs.
The domestic production tax benefit is helping us invest in American manufacturing at a time when many U.S. companies are still sourcing products from abroad.
Lots of lobbyists are using that same jobs argument, buttonholing members of Congress and saying, hey, the money from my tax break is used to create jobs in your district. Lee Drutman is a senior fellow at the Sunlight Foundation, which tracks lobbying and fundraising.
Every tax break got into the tax code based on some justification, but in totality, they add up to a whole stinking mess of craziness.
Drutman estimates that companies and interest groups spent at least $619 million lobbying on tax issues over the past 2 years. And they aren't just defending their tax breaks. Some want to create new ones. The National Brewers Association is a trade group of small independent breweries. They want a lower excise tax rate on their beer. The association is based in Boulder, Colorado. Bob Pease is chief operating officer. Once a month, he leaves his beloved Rocky Mountains for the Hill. Capitol Hill, that is, to lobby.
Oh, it's been a big part of my life for the last 2.5 years.
But what's he thinking, trying to get a new break into the tax code now? Pease says he has no choice. He has to piggyback on tax reform, try to get his bill attached to it.
Because our bill is so small, we've been told that it will never get considered as a standalone bill.
And Pease says big tax bills don't come along very often. The last time Congress passed major tax reform, 1986. Then, as now, lobbyists were trying to build in new tax breaks or protect old ones. Ken Keyes remembers. He's a leading tax attorney and lobbyist in Washington. But back in 86, he was the top Republican staffer on the House Tax Writing Committee. He recalls leaving one meeting at around 4 in the morning, chased by a determined lobbyist.
I'm leaving the building, and this guy is coming after me and asked me to stop. And I thought, you have to be kidding me.
Despite all that lobbying, Keyes says tax reform succeeded in 86 because both parties were determined to make it happen. He's just not sure there's the same determination this time around. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
Those among us who've had hefty legal bills have wondered why they were so high, wondered whether there was the proverbial finger on the scale. With the acknowledgement right up front that the vast, overwhelming proportion of lawyers only demand what they are rightly owed, some emails uncovered in a court filing last week suggest some of them have indeed been exaggerating their billable hours. Peter Latman wrote the story today for Dealbook in the New York Times. Peter, good to have you with us.
Great to be here.
There's a temptation when you read this piece of yours in the paper this morning to go, I'm shocked to discover that lawyers are overbilling. But honestly, this is somewhat surprising, these emails that came out as a result of this lawsuit.
Well, so the backstory here is fascinating. A law firm sues a guy for nonpayment of his legal bill. He turns around and sues them back and says, you guys overbilled me. They go through pretrial discovery in the case, and these emails turn up, and you have some incredibly damning statements in these emails, basically acknowledgments from these lawyers at this firm that there were some shenanigans going on in the way they worked on this guy's matter.
On the order of hundreds of thousands of dollars, right?
Yeah. So this is a bill that had escalated into about, $600,000 or $700,000, and that's what the dispute is over. I think about $675,000.
You know what this reminds me of? It's you remember back during the .com thing when those analysts were caught with emails saying, "Oh, this stock is a piece of insert four letter word here." You know, I mean, it's kind of the same deal.
Yeah, it's the same old story. And, you know, it is sort of an open secret, not to excuse it, that there is some aggressive billing and there is a constant problem with the billable hour. But it's certainly barely ever admitted in writing, which makes this story somewhat unique.
That idea of the billable hour seems to me is at the heart of this, right? Because when you engage a lawyer, I mean, I've had, you know, engaged lawyers for contracts and whatever, and they send you a bill and it says 0.38 hours for telephone calls, whatever, and then they multiply that by the hourly rate. And you're like, no, man, just tell me what it costs. Don't give me the whole every 6 minute increment thing.
Yeah. A professor in my story says, look, the billable hour creates perverse incentives, right? Because you have lawyers who have their own economic interests, which is to increase the hours billed, which is how they get paid.
Yeah.
But oftentimes it's not in the client's best interest to pay more hours. I mean, you want your case settled. You don't want your case to be protracted because that costs you more money. But it makes the lawyers more money.
Which is kind of a conundrum.
It is.
How much are we talking here per hour? I mean, it's not $50 an hour, right?
No. Look, these corporate law firms, and DLA Piper is the law firm that's at the center of this controversy, but the top lawyers there will bill in excess of $1,000 an hour. So,
wow.
You know, my fifth grade daughter could do the math there, right? It adds up pretty quickly if you're billing $1,000 an hour. And even at the low end, the most junior associates bill in the, $300 to $400 an hour range. So, that's why you're seeing these astronomical bills and clients are, crying foul.
Right. Peter Latman at the New York Times. He works on Dealbook there. Peter, thanks a bunch.
Thanks, Kai.
Coming up, too much of a good thing can actually be bad for you.
Once my article hit, they sold out of all of their stock, and then the pre-orders started coming in, and they sold out of all their future stock.
But first, let's do the numbers. Well, you guys, Cyprus is so yesterday. The Dow Industrial zoomed up 0.75% today, 111 points, 14,559 the number. The NASDAQ jumped 0.5%, 17 points, 32.52. The S&P 500 grew 0.75%, 12 points, ended things at 1563. Good news on home prices that I mentioned helped drive that rally. Builder Lennar gained 0.3%. Home Depot built up 0.8%. Lowe's up 0.4%. And Restoration Hardware, hey, you got to spruce the place up, right? Tacked on 1.25%. Netflix continued its comeback. Its shares reeled in more than 5% today. That makes the company one of Wall Street's biggest winners so far this year. Bond prices up. The yield on the 10-year T-note at 1.91%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at Marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at Marketplace.org/the Big Book.
From the Marketplace Date Book, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. The National Association of Realtors releases its monthly pending home sales index. It looks at housing contract activity for February. Speaking of homes, Graceland, home to Elvis, was declared a National Historic Landmark 7 years ago. And a sure sign of spring, the Cherry Blossom Festival continues in the nation's capital. It celebrates the gift of 3,000 Japanese cherry trees in 1912. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. All right, I know I said up at the top of the program we're not going to talk about budget deficits, and we're not, but we are going to talk around them. Because one of the big policy debates we're having in this country right now is about the social safety net. Nobody likes to talk publicly about needing it, about needing help. But that safety net has very public consequences, because depending on how you define it, a lot of it is paid for by we the people. So today we're going to start our own exploration of that topic, an occasional series we're going to call Show Me Your Safety Net. To get us going, Chrissy Clark from the Wealth and Poverty Desk gets up close and personal.
A man named Richie Gayona is in his backyard looking up at a woman who is quivering on a platform 30 feet in the air. And that woman is me.
How you feel?
Oh, I'm a little shaky.
Good.
Gayona is a fourth-generation acrobat. He runs a trapeze school out of his house in Woodland Hills, California.
Okay, can we just go over what I'm going to do one more time?
I'd ask Gayona to give me a crash course, no pun intended, in trapeze, and now I'm freaking out.
But you know what? There's a net below you.
Thank God.
All right, reach for the bar.
Before I reach for the bar that's swinging toward me, let's pause and talk about that safety net I'm looking down at. It's really why I'm here. I figured a good way to launch a discussion about metaphoric safety nets would be to try out an actual one. But first, I wanted the basics. Richie Gayona's net is made of nylon. It's 55 feet long.
It spreads out to about 12 feet wide.
What is the point of a safety net?
That's a funny question. It's for when we do tricks. We can have the confidence to do all those tricks and not worry about dying.
Okay, then. And if you talk to policy wonks instead of acrobats, you actually get a very similar definition. Here's a sociologist from Northwestern University named Celeste Watkins-Hayes.
Safety nets are there to ensure that there's a basic floor that provides resources for everyone's survival.
Of course, safety nets cost money. A real one, according to my trapeze teacher, Gayona, goes for
almost $5,000.
The cost of a metaphoric safety net is obviously way bigger. And that's where a lot of the debate comes in. Here's Watkins-Hayes again.
Resources for low-income families often end up on the chopping block when there are conversations about budget cuts.
Monies for the social safety net do not come from heaven. They come from taxes.
That's Richard Birkhauser, an economist at Cornell and a fellow with the American Enterprise Institute.
Americans believe that anybody who works hard and plays by the rules shouldn't be poor. But we basically made too many promises based on the taxes that are there to provide for them, and we have to make some decisions about how to balance those systems.
Which brings us to the subject of bounce. The best safety nets have a little bounce, which makes them safer and softer to fall into, as one of Richie Gaiona's youngest acrobats, Gabby, explains.
The net is like a gigantic, like, bed. Like a gigantic hammock.
But Gaiona's got a class to run, so no one gets to stay in the net too long.
They get shoved off.
Shoving isn't a word Burkhauser, the economist from Cornell, would use. He prefers nudge. But he thinks getting people out of the safety net is important. What the welfare reforms of the 1990s did, he says, with more work incentives, and what he hopes will happen with more programs in the future.
Nudge people into the workforce, which is what society expected of them.
That's, of course, controversial, but controversy is woven into the safety net, metaphoric nets and real ones. Richie Gaiona points to the issue of going without a net. Turns out, it only happens in the movies. In real life?
Some nets are black, you know, so it blends in with the audience. In some shows, you don't even see the net.
The same goes for the metaphoric safety net. Suzanne Mettler argues this point in her book, The Submerged State.
It's really a bit of a smoke and mirrors.
Mettler says usually when people think of the safety net, they think of policies for the poor, elderly, or disabled. But she says there's a less obvious safety net that helps middle class and wealthier people. Tax deductions on mortgage interest that reward homeowners but not renters. Tax deductions on savings accounts for college that go to people who have enough money to save.
Our policy design is obscuring government's role in helping people out to do particular things.
Another funny thing about safety nets, if you've always had one to catch you, it's easier to take it for granted. Since Richie Gaiona grew up in a circus family, the Flying Gaionas, he knows the net will catch him.
To me, it doesn't even click that it's there because it's been there all my life.
Celeste Watkins-Hayes, that sociologist from Northwestern, says it's the same for people who grew up in well-off families.
Getting assistance from parents to buy the first home, help paying for college, those kinds of things kind of create an invisible private safety net so that if you do fall on hard times, you've got a wealth of assets that you can call upon to help protect you.
Ready, set.
And so here I stand, 30 feet in the air with visions of too many kinds of safety nets flying through my head, looking down at an actual one.
Jump!
There you go.
I scream, but I do manage to hold on to the trapeze bar. Then I'm upside down, reaching for the outstretched arms of my catcher, and I don't make it the first time. But I never would have tried if I didn't have that net. I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
What helped you climb up or bounce back, as the case may be, when things got rough? Go to marketplace.org and click on Safety Net. Let us know. You know when you get something new that's really cool, some gadget or a pair of running shoes or something, I don't know, and you want to tell your friends about it? Well, that's exactly what happened with Farhad Manju back in December, only he didn't just put it on Facebook or send a couple of emails. He wrote about it on Slate under a headline that said, "The Greatest Hoodie Ever Made." Readers bought it. They bought the headline and the hoodies. They bought so many of those hoodies, in fact, that the company called American Giant had to completely change its business model just to keep up with demand. Farhad, it's good to have you with us.
Good to be here.
So what did you do to this company, man?
Oh, I just praised them. I praised them so much that they had problems.
One of the things that I thought was interesting was that the CEO of this company said, what you did to us, you meaning you in this case,
yeah,
was force upon him permanent change before he was ready.
Yeah, I think that was interesting. I mean, he, like most small businesses, had this kind of roadmap in mind for how much they'd grow this year and how much they'd grow next year. Once my article hit in December, they sold out of all of their stock, and then the pre-orders started coming in, and they sold out of all their future stock. So they had to kind of make a big investment to get a lot more material through the pipeline.
To the tune of millions and millions of dollars.
Yeah, he said that the production line now, after their investments, is going to be capable of producing 15 to 20 times as much as they were producing back in December.
Here's the thing, though, and you point this out in your piece. I mean, shouldn't anybody who goes to the internet to, in essence, market their business and run it, be somehow prepared for this catastrophic success, as it's been called?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's easier to say than to do. I mean, and it's yeah. If you run a software company, if what you make is sort of a digital item, it's really easy to scale up. For a business that makes stuff in the real world, for them to scale up takes much more resources and planning and just time. It takes a long time to make sweatshirts. I mean, that's the main thing. You can't kind of do it overnight.
Why not just outsource all this manufacturing to, say, Shenzhen, right? And you can throw as many Chinese workers as are willing to get up in the middle of the night to boost production, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's possible. One of the things that American Giant told me was that they think that would have taken even longer. One of the problems with manufacturing overseas is that it's difficult to keep an eye on quality there, and it's difficult for a small American business to quickly get, you know, new facilities to kind of figure out where to produce more stuff. So scaling up there would have been more difficult, or at least would have taken more time.
Last thing before I let you go, $79 for a sweatshirt, man, that's a little steep, don't you think? Was it really that good?
It was great. You know, I wear it every day, and I still, you know, I put it up there with my iPhone in terms of an object that I still marvel at its quality and, you know, how much I appreciate using it.
All right, then. Farhad Manju covers technology for Slate, also, I guess, hoodies, too.
Yeah.
Is that your new beat, right? Farhad, thanks.
Thanks a lot.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, in which we fast forward to the 2014 Winter Olympics in Sochi, Russia, and yet another example that hosting the Games can be more trouble than they are worth. It's been a warm winter over in Sochi, I guess, and they're worried about having enough snow on the ground when the Games begin next February. So the ski resort up in the Caucasus Mountains that's going to host the downhill skiing alpine events is going to store 450,000 cubic meters of snow up at altitude in seven special holding places, even allowing for melting. They figure they'll have more than half of it left. All told, it's going to cost $11 million for snow. All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from APM. Thanks to Sean Bowditch, Katie Long, Justin Ho, and Lana Anwar on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.